The Last Word with Matt Cooper.
Today FM.
It all happens here.
So how disreputable and immoral an organisation has Facebook become in its pursuit of growth for ever-expanding profits? And how irresponsible has it been as well in the platforms it has provided to those who would do things that are not in the common good? There's a terrific new book called An Ugly Truth, Inside Facebook's Battle for Domination. It's written by Cecilia Kang and Shira Frenkel. Cecilia is with us. Thank you very much for taking the time to join us on the programme. The way I've introduced Facebook there, have I perhaps exaggerated its impact and effects a little bit too much, or are these things that we do need to talk about?
Oh, I think that the themes generally are absolute things we should talk about. I think there are people even within the company that would not disagree with you at all. There's a real pattern that we show in this company of that sort of repeated behavior of growth at all costs, driving decisions that where executives decide to ignore warnings of problems, the problems emerging and actually falling out and affecting all of the users and as well as the world. And this pattern repeating itself over and over again.
Take one example for me, please. What happened on January 6th? What's still shocking to those of us who watched it unfold on television and the subsequent videos that emerged, the attack on the US Capitol, the insurrection. How much of that can be blamed on Facebook as a platform? And how much responsibility does Facebook bear for not reporting to the authorities what it knew it was facilitating and what it knew was coming?
Well, I'll describe a little bit of what happened. It was on January 6th, even before the Capitol insurrection on January 6th, there were warning signs that were so clear to the security team at Facebook right after the election. Far-right groups formed what was became known as a movement called Stop the Steal. They believed that the election was falsified and that Donald Trump did win the election and that the election was stolen from the former president. So they were organizing on Facebook's platform as well as through many of its tools in the groups on the platform itself generally, as well as through messaging. And they were posting photos, for example, of rifles that they were planning to bring to Washington and talking about organizing and their plans for their trip, even like travel plans that they were posting. So all of this was taking place and the security team did see this. They did actually try to warn top executives that this was a really big problem. The security team also, which has expanded, I should say, quite a bit over the last few years amid all the scandal, did try to take down much of this content and try to prevent a lot of this from spreading. But that said, Facebook is, the content comes up and Facebook is constantly playing whack-a-mole. And what I mean by that is they're trying to sort of kill off what they see as problematic content after the fact. But oftentimes, as in this case, it just spread too fast.
But can you really say that? Because it almost has struck me that in relation to Facebook, if you put up copyrighted material, they're very quick at being able to get that down. You put up incendiary, incitement material, and yet somehow that manages to stay up for long enough for plenty of people to see it and share it.
Yes, I mean, it's a really good question. Facebook has great artificial intelligence that detects copyrighted material. There's watermarks and other ways to detect what is copyright. They also have the pressure of publishers to take down that content, and there are laws that don't allow them to spread that. When it comes to misinformation and harmful information, in other words, just the exchange of content and speech between users on the site, that's where things get really tricky for Facebook. Facebook has a very strong free expression bent, and it's really coming up with its rules on the go. It's an ad hoc process where they come up with rules on how to control the spread of, as well as what they allow and rules on what they actually allow and they insist on taking down. So it's that kind of content that's that sort of the talking, the sharing of photos, the organizing on Facebook between users where Facebook is really struggling currently with speech on its site.
And then, Cecilia, how cynical was it to then ban Donald Trump At what was the point in which he knew he was finally defeated and had lost the US presidency and Mike Pence had endorsed the vote once the insurrection was suppressed, for Facebook then to turn around and say, well, we're not going to have him on our platform anymore?
Yeah, and Matt, I would also note that this was after Twitter had announced that they would ban permanently the former president, Trump. And in a way, Twitter forced Facebook's hand. Facebook is always sort of following suit. Absolutely. And I would also note that Facebook did not permanently ban Trump right away, and nor is he permanently banned today. They said that they would indefinitely and temporarily ban Trump 2 weeks after the Capitol insurrection. And they took that decision, a final decision on Trump, to what they called the Facebook Oversight Board, which is a third-party organization that basically acts like a Supreme Court, is how Facebook describes it, on big content decisions. The Supreme Court basically said, the Facebook Oversight Board told Facebook, no, we're not going to make this decision for you. You have to figure out what your own rules are on political figures like Trump. You have a special shield for him, a special carve-out for him and other politicians that allow them to violate your rules on hate speech and misinformation. But so you have to figure out, well, what is the final line for you? So the Facebook Oversight Board kicked that decision back to Facebook. And Facebook now has to decide after, you know, ultimately what they plan to do. Right now, President Trump, the former president, is banned on Facebook for 2 years. That means he will be allowed back on the site just in time to potentially run for a 2024 campaign for presidency again.
Which brings me back to the 2016 campaign, which he did win. You and Shira are experienced journalists with the New York Times who've been covering these issues for many years. But for your book, you've done more than 1,000 hours of interviews with executives and current and former employees and investors and advisors, as well as family members and friends of the key people like Mark Zuckerberg. But did you get any sense of any regret or any acceptance within Facebook that it played an extremely powerful role in bringing Trump to power?
Oh, yes. I mean, among the rank and file, even among executives, there is a lot of feeling of guilt, a lot of feeling of concern that the guilt over what happened in 2016, but a lot of concern looking forward that the company may not be prepared for continued testing of its site by figures, political figures, not just like Trump, but around the world, people, political leaders, and you see them all over the world who know how to use Facebook to spread misinformation oftentimes and seize more control. So there is absolutely a recognition within the company that they have taken on an incredibly powerful role in the exchange of ideas, in the exchange of speech. And they also, there's a recognition also within that this is kind of like an airplane that's in flight that hasn't quite built all of its landing gear yet. They just haven't quite figured out exactly how they can handle information going forward. And I think that's really frightening to people.
I think for many of us, our initial impressions of Mark Zuckerberg might have been formed by the movie The Social Network, of this rather dislikable individual, quite brilliant in his own way, but also, you know, given that Facebook effectively was initially set up as a way of ranking women in university. Mm-hmm. Have you got any sense that has he matured from that position, or is he suffering in the way that many billionaires do, is that there's very few people around him to tell him, Mark, you're doing this wrong, this can't be done this way, or is he just indulged because of his power and wealth?
Well, I think he certainly is indulged, and I think that's a lot of the Silicon Valley culture where founders are treated like kings. You have this sort of founder mythology in Silicon Valley that gives the CEOs and founders so much power and control, and they're sort of hailed as brilliant visionaries. And there's a lot of downdraft for that, and you know how that affects the structure of companies. You know, Mark Zuckerberg is somebody who we've all seen grow up in front of our own eyes. I do think that The Social Network was the first introduction to him as an individual, to much of the world. I think a lot of the things, frankly, the movie probably got not right, and some things they absolutely did get right. Mark Zuckerberg is incredibly human in many ways. He is not checked, however, and he doesn't have people around him in this very close circle of lieutenants who he trusts, who allow difficult and challenging point of views to even reach him. I think that he's human in that, again, we're seeing him grow up in front of our eyes, and he's making the biggest decisions right now on Facebook. And one example in our book is, you know, there was a speech that the U.S. House leader, Nancy Pelosi, she's the most powerful person in Congress on the House side, gave, and a user of Facebook posted a doctored video of her where she appeared drunk, basically. And there was, it spread very rapidly. The House leader's office, their staff, called Facebook and said, "You must take this down. This is obviously false and misleading news." And what was really surprising to us was hearing from people about what happened behind the scenes on making a final decision on that video. There was so much back and forth about what constituted real speech, satire, what constituted, you know, sort of misinformation, and what lines they wanted to draw. Ultimately, it was Mark Zuckerberg who made the decision and said that the video should be held up. He said, "This is not a deep fake video. This is a doctored video." And he was kind of making up these different definitions on the fly. And that is just one example of many in our book where we show Mark Zuckerberg's incredibly powerful role as the decision maker, not just on the technology, not just on the business, but on these really consequential decisions on the content on Facebook.
Cecilia, a question you may not or may be able to answer for us, but there was a video recently, and I want to know, was this a deep fake of Mark Zuckerberg on a surfboard been drawn across a lake with an American flag in his hand to mark the 4th of July? Was that real or was that a deep fake?
Oh, Matt, that was 100% real.
Ah, come on.
It was 100% real. It really was. It was quite astounding. Yes, he was on a wakeboard, I believe, on Lake Tahoe, we think, carrying an American flag with John Denver's Country Roads, Take Me Home, playing it in the backdrop. And he was essentially surfing on this, I think, motorized, looked like a mini surfboard. And it was absolutely him. He likes to post videos of himself, you know, doing these activities that are, you know, a little bit off or odd or like not really common, I should say. And I should also note that this video was posted a couple weeks after a massive victory for Facebook in the courts in the U.S. A federal court threw out a lawsuit by the Federal Trade Commission, the most powerful oversight board of oversight agency of Facebook, and they this lawsuit sought to break up Facebook. So I don't know if it was intentionally linked to that, but it certainly looked like a celebration and that all obstacles were cleared ahead because of this lawsuit.
That actually brings me to the final point I wanted to bring up. And thank you, Cecilia Kang, for taking the time for this. It's been fascinating about one of the world's most powerful and influential companies. But is it possible that Facebook can be broken up in the way that in the era of big oil in the United States over 100 years ago, the big oil giants became too big and had to be broken up for the economic benefit of the United States? Does the same need to be done to Facebook for not necessarily economic reasons, but for social reasons in the Western world?
Yeah. I mean, right now it feels that we've thought about this a lot, Shira Frankel and myself, my co-author, about what's the future for Facebook. And it seems like this company is so powerful and dominant. I mean, as we've seen, it has a $1 trillion valuation. Like, what could actually happen to slow it down? I think the change could happen from the outside. I think history is a guide. I think the same things were being said about the big oil trusts and the railroad trusts of a century ago. I think the same things were being said about AT&T the biggest telephone company in the U.S. in the 80s. And the same thing was being said about AOL. I don't think AOL and Yahoo in the early days of the internet, and look at where those companies are now. I think it's the change could come from the outside. If it was broken up, you would see potentially, I think what regulators would like to see is the three apps broken up, WhatsApp, Instagram, and Facebook, that are all owned by the company Facebook. But I do think it's really important, Matt, to remember that even if that were to happen, the business model would remain intact. The business model being behavioral advertising that's really generated and fueled by this growth goal, as well as the technology that makes you want to engage constantly with the company, with the app. And until that business model is addressed, you may just be creating three mini Facebooks that could grow really big too.
It's a terrific book, An Ugly Truth Inside Facebook's Battle for Domination. It's written by Cecilia Kang and Shira Frankel. Cecilia, thank you so much for joining us here on The Last Word of Today FM.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper.
Weekdays from 4:30. Today FM.